Hey everyone, welcome to Office Hours with Cloud Posse, your weekly dose of insider DevOps trends, AWS news, and Terraform insights, all sourced from our SweetOps community, plus a live Q&A you can't find anywhere else. It's October 23rd, 2024. I'm your host, Eric Osterman. Real quick, I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. We're a DevOps accelerator for AWS infrastructure that helps teams deploy their software faster. We do this by leveraging over 200 Terraform modules that have been battle tested and downloaded over 100 million times. So, no matter where you find yourself on this journey, we are here to help you launch better products faster. If you're curious, just head over to cloudposse.com/meet. Again, cloudposse.com/meet. Answer a few quick questions, and you'll book a meeting with me directly. All right. So, how can you maximize today's session? Well, first off, our format's very informal. You can engage as much as you like, ask questions. And if you're curious about any of our open source tools or modules, go for it. And for those of you on the recording, we host these calls live. So don't miss out. You can join us by going to cloudposse.com/officehours. Again, cloudposse.com/officehours. Now, I do have one ask. If you find any portion of today's session valuable, head over to youtube.com/cloudposse, find it, and share it with your team. I'm sure they'll also enjoy it. So with that said, let's get into the news and announcements. First up is something I found when looking up. I was curious if it was possible to use AWS to SAML as a Go module inside of other projects. And I wanted to find an example of doing that. And it turns out that this Kubernetes Connection Manager does exactly that. But not only that, it's kind of nice. We've shared a bunch of these little utilities over the years in Office Hours. This one supports EKS, AKS, and Rancher, and it will help you authenticate first with your cloud, help you find the Kubernetes cluster you want to connect to. You can use the interactive text UI to select it, and it sets up your kubeconfig conveniently for you then for that cluster. So under the hood, it's using SAML to AWS, which was what led me to it. All right, before I move on, any questions on this one? All right. Next announcement was something that crossed my path. It was just funny. I would no affiliation. Don't know who it is. I don't own it. Not responsible, and I wouldn't want to be. But somebody did buy terraform.tf and redirect it to OpenTofu. So probably gonna get a. Their domain jacked. All right. Why does everyone run ancient versions of Postgres? Well, to be honest, I didn't get through the article yet. I forgot to this morning, but it did resonate with me. So if you are running an out-of-date version of Postgres, you're not alone. And Neon, makers of a very cool Postgres compatible database, of course, have a solution that they're probably promoting. But TLDR is the databases don't optimize around upgrade paths. And considering you have to upgrade so often, it's kind of surprising. All right. Next one. This caught my eye. I have I've been seeing more articles around this lately. Not sure if it's just, selection bias. You buy a pair of Nikes and suddenly everyone has the same pair as you do. But seen a lot more conversation around this, and this was on InfoQ, a write-up about when cell-based architectures make sense, what are they to begin with, drawing an analogy to the bulkheads, for example, on ships where you can lose some portion of those bulkheads before the actual ship sinks. And the same is kind of true in a cell-based architecture for infrastructure, where you can create autonomous cells more or less that operate independently, so long as you find some way to route traffic to them and decide on how you segment your traffic, whether you shard it based on tenants in your app, like for an enterprise SaaS application or some other mechanism. The whole thing, though, is you don't necessarily want to rely on an elaborate replication scheme between all this because that's where it all falls apart. Any one have experience working with cell-based architectures? I think it talks about some companies here also that are notable for promoting this, including Tumblr, Flickr, Facebook, Salesforce, Slack moved to this after encountering a bunch of zonal issues at AWS.
Doesn't Netflix also do something like that?
Yeah, I think that they can shut down complete data centers.
Yeah, they had like yeah, it's interesting. They're doing like something with GraphQL Federation to help facilitate part of that.
And with that said, if you're not Netflix or one of these kind of companies, maybe it's not time yet. It's definitely more expensive to operate, more complicated, premature if you are a bootstrap startup. Don't over-architect or can take these things into consideration immediately. However,
Also, part of this, what I was saying before in the last few meetings with service discovery, just the kind of basic concepts behind service discovery allows you to, how can I say, have the conceptual foundation to build something like this.
that's
Without
true.
that kind of understanding, there's just no way. I think it's going to be really hard. Netflix also, they have their own homegrown, like Eureka or something like that for service discovery. So they're using that to basically route traffic to different cells, or I mean, different disaster recovery. It's like if you have a reduced service type service, it will route to, to the service or whatever.
But my understanding, though, is for the most part within a cell, everything stays within the cell, and there's very little, if any, cross-cell traffic by design. But one shameless shill for Atmos, perfect tool when you are working towards a cell-based architecture. When you define your architecture in terms of these reusable stacks, bringing up a complete replica of that in a separate region or in a separate, some sort of separate capacity, is much more straightforward. And it forces you to think about a lot of these things upfront when you're building your architecture. So, that is atmos.tools. That's one of our cornerstones of everything we do at Cloud Posse. Check it out. All right. Next one is. I'm going to go out of order just since it's a better segue into the next topic, or into another topic that caught my attention. So EKS now supports the Application Recovery Controller, which is a controller you deploy to the Kubernetes cluster. And I don't know the technical way it is implemented. I could imagine it's basically tainting any parts of your cluster operating in a degraded zone. But the part that was really interesting to me is how it could help you across regions. So I'm curious, anyone looked into this more?
Not yet, but the words zonal auto shift are scary, but cool.
Yeah, nice name. And on a related note, was something that was also a big pain in the butt if you ever operated with Aurora global databases. It was really left up to you in the end to know which endpoint to write to. That is now addressed in this update. There's now a global writer endpoint, so you don't need to update your applications. You just point to the single endpoint, and it will write to the appropriate online. Master database. Next up, let's see, moving around here. Continuing on the bandwagon, my expression, I forget. Anyways, constant recurring theme here is open source, right? Shining light on companies that are making a difference as it relates to open source and supporting open source. And one of those has always been Cloudflare. Cloudflare, Alexandria, is it Alexandria? Yeah, is a project where they donate resources to open source projects meeting certain criteria and specific types of open source licenses. And those projects are donated compute credits, basically quotas. They're the equivalent of S3 storage, which is R2, and many of the enterprise features available under Cloudflare. This is also what OpenTofu has received. So, Cloudflare is supporting OpenTofu, giving them bandwidth and compute to run the registry and everything else. I think this is really interesting. I think there is an open source program at AWS, but I think AWS should have a formal program, something like this, where projects can apply to get compute resources and so forth, and something like what they have going on here. If anyone knows more about that, reach out to me. All right. Next one was something that I feel like I should have just known because I've spent so much time working with .GitHub repos. But I just learned yesterday that the same private th there's a special repository, at least for public repos called .GitHub, and they call it the it's the place where you put your community health files, the things that you want common across all your public open source repositories. We at Cloud Posse also use it for our shared workflows. So we have, if you go to most of our GitHub organizations at Cloud Posse, you'll find a .GitHub repo like this. And the GitHub repo is where you can configure an organizational README that goes underneath a profile folder. So this is, for example, the README that appears on the Cloud Posse GitHub organization. Problem is that's also that, sometimes an organization serves multiple purposes. Sometimes it also serves a private purpose. And what you put forward facing might not be the optimal landing page of an organization for your private repositories and so forth. So that's why I thought it was interesting that there's a .GitHub private repo where you can put the README that is inward facing for your organization. I don't know to what extent it is similar to the .public, sorry, the public.github folder repository, but it does support also the profile mechanism. So you can have a custom landing page for your organization. I'm pretty sure Michael will have a PR up for that later on this afternoon. All right, next announcement. I nailed it. All right, nothing else for me. Any interesting news announcements this week you want to share? I think there was one I might have forgotten. Let's see here. I think there was one in office hours. Okay, there's a question, Matthew. Let's read over yours in a minute. See that. And then let's see here. Rishav. Yeah, so Rishav's been on the last couple office hours asking a lot of questions on how to build GitHub Actions for Terraform. And I haven't had a chance to read through this yet, but I assume it's capturing a lot of the questions you asked. Rishabh, do you want to direct us to some of the interesting things you've done in this write-up on your GitHub action?
Yeah, thanks. Sure thing. It's yeah, there was just really main three things that I wanted to cover with GitHub Actions. I think a lot of often I see these actions just spit out a little one-liner, the plan which says two to create, three to destroy. And I feel like that's a bit of an all or nothing with that kind of summary. Either you know nothing because it's just a one-liner, or you get thousands of lines of plan output. So the first thing I wanted to try and do is get something in the middle ground and get something like this diff of changes. Use GitHub's inbuilt color coding and use a little bit of regex to color code the creating ones with green, destroying red, and so on and so forth. That was the first bit, just to figure out when you're running a plan, how to make it look usable and relevant. And it's worth noting, not everyone loves PR comments, so the same output is present in your workflow log as well. And that's quite handy if you happen to run multiple jobs in a matrix, you get separate outputs for each one. That's all well and good, but the next part being, now that you have ran a plan, usually when you come to apply it, you tend to see a lot of teams just apply with auto-approve, the assumption being that there hasn't been any configuration drift since you created the plan, so the auto-approve should be fine. That always, I don't know, that makes me feel a bit icky because you'd never really know, especially in a prod environment, if you're just applying with auto-approve. Makes me a wee bit nervous. And that's what I wanted to try and address is how do we reuse the plan file? And that comes with two issues, of course. One being storage. Where do you store it for free and access it again? Because now if I ask people to set up a whole AWS S3 bucket or something like that, gonna have to worry about authentication and connectivity. And the second bit is if we are storing the plan file, we kind of got to encrypt it. We can't just have secrets being exposed wherever it's uploaded. So try to address both of those with storing it in GitHub artifacts, because hey, if you're using a GitHub Action workflow, chances are you have a GitHub artifacts assets. And before you do it, encrypt it with a secret. And given that a secret is always obfuscated from the workflow logs, you should never be able to see what the password is, what the passphrase is, and it's encrypted by default. That was part of it. And then also realizing that, hey, people, oh yeah,
This is
go on.
cool. This is really cool that you solved this problem. Are you just using GPG under the hood with a
Oh, I'm
password?
so glad you asked, because I was between two of them, OpenSSL and GPG. And after doing a wee bit of research, it looked like OpenSSL is more of a, it's more widely available. So GitHub Action runners by default have OpenSSL, they don't have PGP, which was the initial choice. So I had to settle for OpenSSL instead. That being said, though, I don't know if I've gone into it in the blog, but it is using Salt, it's using PBDKF encryption, and it's got a lot of terms which sound very fancy. So I just went with it.
And let's
And
see
it's
here.
worth it. Oh yeah, go on.
What is this I'm looking at here?
Oh yeah, sure. So every time you create a commit, you push a commit to your pre-PR branch. In Atlantis and such, you usually have the old PR comments are collapsed or minimized and the new ones added. In this one, you kind of get two options. One is update in place. So for the original PR comment it creates, edit it completely. And that way you get the bonus of having a revision history because every PR comment, you can just click on the little edit thing and you can see what's changed and when. That's quite nice. On the other hand, if you want a clean cut and you want to see it more chronologically, you can choose to recreate it. So that will delete the PR or the delete the previous PR comment and create a new one after your latest commit. That looks cleaner, I think, but at the same time, I kind of prefer the update in place because you get the revision history.
But
And this one right here.
the colors on the left look like the admonition bars, but what is the styling you have here?
So this is unfortunately out of my hand. This is GitHub diff. So when you click on a revision history of a PR comment, it tells you what's changed. The red is
Oh, got it, got it, got
the
it, got
green
it.
is what it is now, and the little yellow is because it just
Okay.
modified text.
Got it, got it. That
And the
makes
final one is the apply bit. So when you're applying, even without getting into the rabbit hole of before or after, I just wanted people to be able to apply it in a way that's sensible. It doesn't include a whole different workflow. And you can reuse that encrypted plan file we uploaded earlier. And that's what it does here. So every time you upload that PR plan file, it's got a little identifier, the naming convention. That naming convention has inbuilt the working directory it was run in, the backend configs, any var files you passed in, the workspace, if you're using workspace. So that way, when you run multiple PRs, each PR branch has its own distinct isolated plan file, which can be determined by itself just by what command is run to generate it. So you can retrieve it at apply time again. And that's what it does. So if you choose to apply after merge, you can do that. If you choose to apply before merge, which is what I'm quite keen on, this merge queue thing I think you mentioned in our last office hours, that was something which is super fascinating because if the apply fails for any reason, you can actually reject it from being merged, and you can spit out the apply error output back in as a PR comment. So you can see what's gone wrong and decide what you want to do with it. You can add in some recovery methods if you like. For example, reapply main branch on top. You can maybe try something else, create a Slack notification, let someone know apply failed. But in any case, the PR will be rejected if you wanted to do that in a merge queue. Neat stuff.
Have you used this in a merge queue, you said?
Yes.
Oh, interesting. Interesting.
This is currently what our current team is using at the moment with a merge queue, and it's just genuinely quite nice. There are some blockers that we have to go through. For example, in a merge queue, say if you merge two or three PRs at the same time, inevitably, whenever the first one gets applied, all the other plan files immediately become stale because they were
Yeah.
created with
How
the
do you solve
original.
that?
So in this case, with a workflow, if you're running in a merge queue, you can add a flag that's called plan parity. That's the name I went with. But essentially, all it does is in a merge queue, it will rerun a plan immediately before an apply, and it will compare the plan diffs of both. If the plan diffs are identical, it will use the new plan instead. So you get around the stale apply issue. If the plan diffs are different by any means, it will use the old one, so you get the stale issue because you're going to have to deal with that. So that way, now we've been able to have Dependabot merge in four or five PRs, safe in the knowledge that it will automatically create a new plan every time as part of the workflow. And if there is no diff, which usually there isn't because we only change one or two resources, it will just merge in a queue. There is a time cost element, as you can imagine, because you're doing a plan again from scratch just before an apply. But you're going to have to do that anyway if you don't use a merge queue because you have to hit update branch. So this just makes it that much easier and smoother in a workflow. And is there anything else? Oh yeah, and this is just, yeah, if you hover over this one right here, you can pass in any argument you like. Anything that you do in a CLI, be that var file, lock, parallelism, your backend config, anything you would pass in a CLI, you can just pass in here with the arg prefix, and it will automatically figure out where it needs to go.
Okay, that's cool. And one point of clarification, artifacts are definitely not free on GitHub private repositories. We paid the price for that at one point. It can get pretty
Ooh.
costly, but just a consideration to be aware of.
That's worth noting because, yeah, the few plan files we've been looking at, the way we've uploaded, they are a few megabytes. Doesn't seem like a lot, but they pile up if you do quite a few commits.
Can yeah, I can. And then what was your strategy in the end to retrieve the artifact?
Oh, yeah. So when you're let's see, if you scroll, is it up a wee bit? There is a screenshot of what the artifact file looks like, I think. There we go. So this one
Yeah.
right here. So when you're uploading the artifact, you'll see it has a wee bit of a weird name. It has the first part is what tool you used, Terraform or Tofu, then the PR number, 310, and then a whole list of argument files that was arguments that were passed in to create it. That's during the upload phase. When you're downloading it back again, it queries GitHub API to list the artifacts with that correct naming pattern. So
So you have a
because you're running it,
deterministic,
oh yeah.
basically, you have a deterministic file name, basically, and you're just
Spot on.
creating, got it.
Spot on. And it doesn't care about the pull request context. So if you run it on a push event trigger, if you run it on a merge queue event trigger, it doesn't matter. It will always query the GitHub API. So it always gets the same deterministic result. And you can grab the name that way. And by default, it'll always pick the latest one.
I assume there's a security consideration associated with this in some way.
Absolutely. This is one of the big reasons why I always like for GitHub Actions like this, if there's an element of would I really trust a third party rando to look at my infra, run things and
Well, there's
return?
that, but I mean, in terms of just in terms of selecting the artifact this way, what assurances is it that I'm selecting the artifact actually from that PR versus just some are you validating ultimately the like that pull request, this artifact was associated with that pull request and that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So as part of getting that deterministic output for the name value, it has to run the GitHub query twice, one during subload to get the name in the first place. And then when you're downloading it back again, you're having to run the query API again. If anything changes, for example, if the pull request number is different, it won't grab it. It will fail out. It will let you know because, hey, we can't find the matching one. I've been
Cool.
surprised, and it's worth
I
noting. I know I wrote it. Oh,
think
sorry, go on.
it's really good. Yeah.
I was just going to say, I know it sounds a bit stodgy. This isn't something that I cooked up over the weekend. Not that fancy. If you have a look at the VPA, the little repo, this has been an ongoing side project for about a little over a year or so. So this
Oh,
is version 12 of it, actually. But hey,
you're preaching to
every.
the choir here. We've spent as tw twice as long at least building GitHub Actions and stuff like that. And you're doing some things here that is really nice for a generic open source, anyone using Terraform or OpenTofu, vanilla, outside of a framework like what we do, which is Atmos, then this looks like a great solution.
You're spot on. That was exactly it. Because I was looking through a few of your GitHub Actions and was like, this is pretty solid, mature stuff. You're using sophisticated DynamoDB for state blocking and everything. Like, that's full on thought out
But we
stuff.
hate that you have to deploy all that, right? So we also want to have an alternative approach which uses artifacts much the same way. So I'm glad you solved some of those problems. We might have a look at that in our actions to create a
Oh.
version that doesn't require some of that other stuff to be provisioned.
No worries at all. No, thanks for giving me the time. Appreciate it.
Very cool.
I'm actually curious on the merge queue. Actions there when a particular pull request fails, like in the merge queue, are you doing anything for like automated rollback? Because
Oh,
like
fantastic.
imagine a PR has like 1,000 resources, it applies 300 of them, and then it fails. I know you said you reject the PR in GitHub, but that does nothing to the actual resources that got deployed, like partially deployed, as part of that, as part of that pull request. So I'm just curious if you thought through that or have an implementation that solves that.
You're 100% right, and this is something we still discuss internally as well. Because yeah, there's a few different things you can do. You can potentially apply and approve on just the main branch. So if your GitHub action, your apply fails in the merge queue, as part of the rollback, you can choose to auto-approve main branch. So you're back to a settled state. The thing is, though, that's not always possible either. Sometimes whatever you've provisioned in the PR branch, if that's too much, too long, too permanent in some way, even applying main branch will fail. So now you're stuck in a place where not only did your original apply fail, your rollback apply failed as well. And that kind of lets us in a wee bit of a stinky situation of, well, what else can we do? I guess we can send notifications if something fails to let someone know, but that doesn't really fix it as much as just let someone know. One thing we have tried to do is just to give it a shot, we can apply again. And that's one thing you can try of, hey, if some resource, something failed to provision, give it another apply because that's what you might expect to do locally. But to be honest, that's still another one of those. If you're needing two applies to provision it, you haven't done it right. You need to kind of rethink it through. So, ultimately, to answer rollback strategies, it's open to how you want to implement it. There isn't anything that's built in to do it one way or another because ultimately, there's a good answer
We've
for it.
clearly like hit this, we have a very large enterprise customer we're working with right now that has been talking a little bit about like what to do if that happens. So I was just curious if you had some real world experience under your belt that might help inform the decision. But we pretty much came up with the same things that you just listed off are kind of the same choices we came to, and don't know which one is the best. So I guess we're gonna have to kick the tires a little bit and see what works best in their environment.
Spot on. It's a tricky one. I really wish there was a recommended solution, but there just isn't anything that's universal, I don't think.
Yeah, it would be great if like Terraform applies were done in a transaction, basically,
Right.
so that if it fails anywhere, it rolls itself back. That would be fantastic.
Yeah, because every time I just think through of one of those a one of the things we resources we provision out is those private CA certs. They'll cost like $400. It's like, do I really want to deprovision that only to reprovision that after? I don't know. I know, right? No AI fix for this. What's going on?
Yeah, sometimes the rollback is to leave it in a state that you cannot do anything with it. Except go into the state and start deleting stuff and manually delete the resources outside of Terraform.
That's exactly it. That was one of the things actually for when I was putting together this little GitHub action. I was wondering, should I add support for sun lock? So if for any reason your state is locked, it would be nice to be able to run a GitHub action and just unlock it for you. But at the same time, it's already hard enough to trust a GitHub action to touch your critical infra. Now I'm going to have to trust it to break locks. I don't know about that.
I was thinking if you want a destructive use case, the test, you could do like provision something in Kubernetes with like a service load balancer. And then that goes and provisions the service load balancer outside of Terraform, but then use a data source to use stuff to configure based on that service load balancer, which may not exist, and the whole thing collapses and you can't delete, and then you have to do this manual thing. But handling that, if you could handle that use case, that's a very good destructive use case.
Now
You know,
that's
whether
actually a
if information to the user or whatever, like on what's going on, that could be useful.
Just having that info. Oh, and that's a good point that raises is we I know we've only looked at like planning and applying, but for this GitHub action, it also takes care of like workspace selection, initialization, tests to validate and format. Just it's not enabled by default because I feel like if you care about formatting, you're probably got a pre-commit hook to do it for you. You don't need a GitHub action to tell you about it, but if you really want to, you can pass in a flag and just let it know that, hey, I want you to do a quick format or a validate before running plans instead. But anyhow, this is the cheapo's version of running a tacos in your GitHub, of just storing it all in GitHub.
If,
I'm sure it costs nothing to develop.
well, except time. I just want to point out that, I think that pre-commit hooks are kind of like spaces versus tabs. Some people really like them and enjoy them and everything else, and some people rail against them and hate them and would never work at a company that forces them to run pre-commit hooks. And like legit, I've heard that level of debate about them. And so the one thing that I would say, at least from that perspective, is if you're gonna run plan and if you're gonna run like format from pre-commit hook type of thing, if you don't do it in pre-commit hook, you can at least do it in CI, but you can run them in parallel. So you can actually run your pre-commit checks and all of that kind of thing to make sure that it works, but you can also run your plan. So you get the plan, but you may also get feedback like, hey, your formatting's off, so you need to run format, or it formats and commits to the branch itself or whatever you do. But at least if those two things happen in parallel, you don't you like at the developers that are railing against pre-commit hooks are doing it because they don't want to think about that now. They want to think about it prior to the PR being finalized, but not in the iteration cycle of it. And I think that that's like one of those things, like you can let them both happen at the same time and let them get their feedback as quickly as possible, but also get the whatever would be in a pre-commit hook feedback as well, but just like in a parallel thread that runs at the same time. So that's just my two cents on that one.
Agreed. I'd probably say that's the best of both worlds.
Cool. Well, other questions that we can get to today? We got about 20, 25 minutes here.
Hey, I got a question if you can hear me.
Yeah, I got you, Michael.
Awesome. I'm in a funky situation where I have Linux servers that are on premises and I need them to write to an S3 bucket. And I mean, I know, I can put profiles on these servers and have long-lived keys that can let them assume a role that let them do what they need to do. Haven't done that in a while, so I'm just trying to see if there's anything else that I should consider. I'd like for it to be as automated as possible and not have to like manually touch a whole bunch of servers. Well, I mean, if I have to manually touch them to set up whatever the solution is, that's fine. But I'm
If
trying.
you're just writing to S3, the storage gateway, the appliance is free. So then you're just paying for the storage and the network consumed. So I use the storage gateway for things like that to write local workloads to my S3 cloud. It caches it locally and writes it.
Okay, so you're saying storage gateway runs locally on the server itself or on the same network, and then the
It runs
storage
as,
gateway has the permission.
yeah, it runs as a VM on your net, on your local network, and
Got
what
it.
you mount local storage to it that it uses as a cache for whatever backing stores you point it to. You can use it with SMB or NFS. So that depends on how you're set up. I think it's easier with NFS, but that's your call. But they used to charge to run the appliance every hour, and they don't anymore. So now it's really just a free on-prem gateway that you can use to read and write to your S3 buckets. And to that
Oh,
end,
sweet.
it lets you do something very similar with block storage devices. So if you wanted to mirror your block storage devices from on-prem into the whatever, there's a gateway that does that for, there's other gateways, but those are the two free ones.
Cool.
What are the two free ones again?
The S3 file cache, and then there's an EBS block cache, as I believe the word, David.
If you find any links for these.
Oh,
Yeah,
sorry.
give me a second. I'll find them and I'll put them in the chat. I'll find the links.
Yeah, I
Yeah,
was also
you.
going. Oh, sorry.
No,
Go
please
ahead.
go. No, please go ahead.
I was mine's a slightly different solution recommendation. So if it's on this topic that you were going to say, go ahead and finish your thought, and then I'll talk about mine.
Yeah, sure. No, I was going to say, yeah, that the storage gateway is helpful. I'll take a look at it. But yeah, if you got something else, because right now I'm just kind of in the brainstorming phase before I start tackling the problem. So yeah, that's why I'm just kind of, beating the bushes to see what comes out.
Yeah, so oh,
Sure.
sorry. I was just gonna recommend I know a while back that Amazon announced IAM Roles Anywhere. So it's essentially the ability for your non-AWS infrastructure to use PKI that you host on AWS to essentially get an IAM role, even though the thing is not running in AWS, and then you can use that. Then it's just an IAM role, and you give permissions to the S3 bucket like anything else, and then you can write to it just like anything else can.
Got it.
And the links are all in the Zoom chat.
There's the also the vault has that kind of way you could have credentials. You could get the credentials just for that use and then rotate them automatically.
That's a good point too. If you already have a Vault implementation.
So it has the kind of random password rotation per usage type scenario. So then that way you
Cool.
get out of rotating the keys and static secrets and things.
Yeah, that's definitely what I'm trying to avoid, if at all possible.
You just got
Yeah.
to rotate that vault token.
Yeah, no, but that's with you and Vault instead of you and the service
Yeah,
online be
that's
compromised.
a little better.
Yeah. The other possibility, depending on what your use case is here, is that you could in theory, also use like pre-signed URLs to upload things. I don't know like how often or how much or whatever you're doing with this, but depending on your use case, if it's fits in that box, that's the simplest of all things to do.
Honestly, that might be the most, well, I mean, and just to qualify the situation, this is like collecting logs and core files from a service on a fleet of servers. So it's not something that's done regularly. It's mostly an ad hoc process. So it could be human, initiated. And if it's the case that we have a pre-signed URL that sits on the server somewhere that somebody can run the script and it kind of does what it needs to do to put the file to S3. Right now, that would stop the bleeding and probably make things pretty easy until I can get to one of these other solutions.
Yeah.
So that, I might consider that just to kind of get things started. Because the difficulty is like these servers, they're on premises in a way that you have to jump to them a couple times. You have to bastion, you have to proxy, and then you have to get to the server. So by the time you get there, it's like, well, okay, how am I even logged in? What are my permissions? What's available, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm looking for the simplest solution possible, but at the same time, I don't want to hard code any credentials on the server. I may not even be able to install the AWS CLI. I don't know yet. I'm brainstorming, right? So anything that can sort of simplify those processes, like if it's just mounting a NFS mount, because they are Linux, I'll probably go NFS for a storage gateway. Yeah, that sounds sweet. If it's a pre-signed URL that I could just say, hey, curl this and provide this payload, and that works, then that could be a good start as well. So I appreciate the input. These sound like good solutions to at least get me started, and I will circle back to let you know how things go.
Yeah, one more one is if you have some other way to identify where these are coming from, like if they're all coming from your internal network and you trust that to be able to post, you could throw up an API gateway, and then you could actually just paste, you could basically just like post all that stuff to API gateway, and then API gateway can use its credentials to write it to S3 basically on the back end. Like you can make that happen too. So
Yes. So basically, you're saying like a policy on the gateway that limits writes or reads from a certain IP range or a certain,
basically, yeah. So basically, like the endpoint would be only permitted to be hit from your IP address range that is your servers, and then API gateway itself can write the data to, S3 or to a queue or to a Kinesis stream or whatever you want to
I'm
do
going to
with it
plug one
and
of
get
my
it there.
favorite things here, and it's Tail Scale, which allows you to create these
Okay.
overlay WireGuard VPN networks. The first tier is free. You could use the free tier to build out what you're talking about here, but this, if you don't have physical connections, create some virtual connection, and Tailscale makes it exceedingly easy.
I've used TailScale like even on my cell phone for stuff like that.
I
Oh,
am
cool.
all in on the Tailscale world. I love it.
Yeah, I just
All
want
right.
to point out that Tailscale isn't going to solve the IAM permission problem that his server can't write to S3, though. You still need to solve that piece. It's only going to help with the connectivity piece of it.
I do see that TailScale will get us to the server faster. But
Yeah.
yes, I still need permission to write.
Yeah.
All
Good
right.
tool. I wasn't saying it's not a good tool. I'm just saying it doesn't solve the initial problem you
Yes.
laid out there. That's all.
Really, it's the hops that are kind of the pain. And if there's anything that I can do to automate it on the server itself to just kind of, make things more of a one-shot process, I prefer to do that. But thank you all for the tips. I really do appreciate it.
Cool. All right. More questions? Anyone got something for us? Any interesting articles, news, announcements over the past week?
Oh, just a quick update. I think last week or the week prior, you had mentioned using a GitHub app for a Renovate bot. Looked at this morning, and it seems like it's working. Like I'm doing a couple tests, but the other thing I found is with GitHub Enterprise, typically what I've done for creating apps is I just go to my org and I create an app. If you run GitHub Enterprise, it appears you create an enterprise-only app, so it only works within your org. So you don't have to. If you have multiple organizations, you don't have to create a public app and then install it across all of them. You can just create one that's only accessible by all of the organizations underneath the enterprise. So if you weren't across that feature, that was new to me today because I've just been creating.
I just deja vu because it was on my list here, and I think I forgot to announce it on the announcement. I don't know if this is the same or different. Enterprise apps and installation automation, and this
Oh,
is in preview now, apparently.
you still didn't see preview in the console, so I wonder if this is something else.
This might be something else. I interpreted this as being able to install apps that operate on enterprise APIs, but it just made me think about it.
Oh yeah, no. So maybe the enterprise, maybe that's what that's for. What I'm referring to is typically if you want to share an app across organizations, you have to create it underneath an org and then share it. You just create it only accessible by the organizations within your enterprise. So,
That's cool. You could benefit from that. Where
it's
where could you
if you go to github.com/enterprises, click on your enterprise. You need enterprise access, so I think you have to be an admin. And then you go to like settings, and so go to settings on the far left. And GitHub Enterprise, yep, GitHub Apps.
Can we transfer apps there now?
Oh, that I'm not too sure about. I didn't
That's
try.
annoying.
That was a question I had
Because
as
we've
well,
just
but
gone through and like created like a half dozen or more apps, and we've installed them into our orgs and done all that, and this would have been a better way.
yeah, totally. This was new to me. I came here by accident. I'm like, whoa, this exists. So, yeah, glad this wasn't redundant information for you either. So awesome.
I guess this is the equivalent of setting an app to internal, like you do with a repo, and then
That's how I look at
it can
it.
be accessed everywhere. Yeah. Interesting.
You still have to install it as you normally would. I don't know if it's any better on changing permissions over time, or if you have to go through all the apps and regrant the new scopes.
Presumably.
Yeah, I would think so. Although if it's in your enterprise and you need enterprise permissions, maybe they're just auto accepted, like in your enterprise, because like an enterprise administrator is basically saying like this app should be available or whatever. So I guess, well, I'll go click the view documentation button that's right there and read it and find out what the
You're gonna get the answer on that.
answer
I'm
is then.
pretty sure that's one of those things we'll have to try and see what happens. But yeah, cool. Hopefully that helps for anyone else creating enterprise or within GitHub Enterprise and having to create a lot of apps.
That is cool. I wonder if then they can also be, they don't have the global uniqueness constraint, maybe? Or did they still have to be globally unique, the names?
I learned about that constraint today on the public-facing app.
Oh,
I wasn't across that. Apparently, if you have a GitHub user named the same thing as an app, the two will step on each other, which I didn't realize.
it doesn't even let you create it.
I
At
mean,
least
you
that was my experience. I
can
tried to create an app called Cloud Posse and it said an org existed for that.
try.
You can actually try new GitHub app and just type in the name and see if it lets you, but.
That's too smart.
Oh, you gotta verify. All right.
Eric. So you're posting directly to me, not through the group chat.
I'm posting to you. Oh, okay. How did? Oh, it's because you were the last person who messaged me, maybe.
Yeah, I think so.
I really hate how Zoom chat works. I cannot get that right. All right, I posted that to group now. Thank you. All right, somebody must have created a GitHub app called Test, right?
I would have expected to error by now. I wonder if it's going to be after you. Let's see what happens.
Yeah.
It
So,
would have been amazing if you got a test,
yeah.
I wonder, can you change it to Cloud Posse now and see if it lets you use that? I'm just curious.
Yeah. Well,
Yeah,
it
so you
did.
can do it. You can do it as a private app since you own the org, I guess.
Yeah.
I bet examples already is too.
Kind of weird that there's a public link. New incognito window. Let's see what we see.
Is there like a webhook assumption here at some level? That's why the links are public.
Yeah, that's conceivable. For what it's worth, when I do go to this, as it says that the app exists, but that it's private. Any
Well,
final questions or observations or questions on this too, Matt?
I was going to just say I can write a script now in 5 minutes that tells you the name of every GitHub app that exists. If it tells you that the app exists but it's private, so now I can and now I can just write something that creates a, basically brute forces it. I guess I would get rate limited eventually by GitHub, but it would be an interesting experiment.
I know some proxy networks you can use, Matt. We can talk
Yeah, me too.
offline.
Me too.
I do have a question. Maybe this is more towards Cloud Posse. So I know you folks have like geodesic and a handful of other containers you folks publish. Do you ever clean up old tags? Or do you guys have any actions or anything that you'd recommend for that? Or do you guys, I know it's all public, so you don't pay for it. I'm just wondering, I guess anyone really here that does public, builds in public and publishes packages to GHCR or similar, do you guys clean up old artifacts at some point or do you just keep it growing?
I don't know. That seems dangerous. If your stuff is used by other people, like, how do you know that the one from 7 years ago isn't used by some guy that relies on it for something, way in the past?
I'm not sure of any rate limits on packages. I haven't dug into it that deep, but it was just multiple questions, I guess. Is there like a limit to how many GHCR containers you
But
publish?
what I was going to say is AWS takes care of that automatically for you because there's a max limit of 10,000 tags or whatever on a repo. That would therefore apply if you're using ECR public. And I can't blame them for having that limit. Where I would like to direct more of our usage is just Google's, sorry, not Google's, GitHub's package registry for Docker images. It's natively integrated within the whole ecosystem. So we have a few images on public ECR, but now I think we should, well, and they'll continue to be there since we started there probably, but for everything new using GitHub.
Got it. Cool.
If I recollect correctly, there was Linkert uses I think GCR. And this is a weird one. Probably guys wouldn't experience this on AWS, but on Azure, it seemed to run into problems downloading pulling images from GCR from Azure. And I don't know why. And I don't know if that was fixed or what the problem is or what the root cause of it is. Because I had to work around it and use ACR or something like that to not use GCR.
No.
Could be Microsoft. I wouldn't be shocked if they did it for anti-competitive purposes, but then they own the company, so I don't know.
Sorry, when you say GCR, are you referring to Google Cloud Registry or are you
Oh
referring
no,
to?
excuse me. I mean the artifact that GitHub uses GHCR.
Yeah, GHCR. Okay.
Yeah,
Yeah.
go for that.